Hey guys, and welcome to the Moms and Mysteries podcast, a true crime podcast featuring myself, Mandy, and my dear friend, Melissa. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Mandy. How are you?
I am doing well.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. And I'm glad that we're acting like we just didn't spend 30 minutes talking for our little Moms and Miscellaneous thing over on Patreon.
Yes. Yes, we had a lot to say this week.
We did. We talked about O.J. Simpson? Not really. Barely. He died. That's spoiler
alert. We talked about that. Yes. Yeah, that was pretty much it.
And then our schedules and stuff like that. So if you're interested, that's at patreon.com/momsandmysteriespodcast. If you're new, we are doing that every week, just a little miscellaneous conversation we have that's not really about true crime, unless you count O.J. Simpson dying. But I don't think I do.
No.
No. Yeah. So anyway,
I've been loving our little Moms and Miscellaneous. It's been nice to kind of just be able to get in front of the microphone with each other and just talk about life and just
everything.
So I've been enjoying that. And so far, the listeners seem like they're enjoying it. So yeah, check that out on Patreon if you're interested in hearing us just talk.
Yeah.
Oof. Which doesn't sound that exciting
now when that you I say that. It like
that. So, Melissa, we have known each other for a pretty long time now, over a decade. And throughout that time, we have watched each other go through various stages of parenting. We kind of talked about this a little bit as well in our Moms and Miscellaneous this week. But we've both had those moments, you know, where we question, how did we ever think we were cut out for raising kids? Because parenting really is a crazy journey and it's pretty chaotic, but of course, we wouldn't trade it for the world. And now that our kids are getting older, we're even getting our feet wet with the whole teenager thing. And it seems like we're both really understanding and appreciating how complicated it is to not only manage everyone's schedules and routines, but also coordinate them so everyone gets what they want and need to do. So it can sometimes be a lot. Melissa, I have been talking to you all week about this. Just the nonstop go, go, go nature of life. I feel like sometimes I go through periods where it doesn't feel like it's a lot. And then sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, we're doing something 24/7.
Well, I saw a meme once that was like, life is all about saying after this week, things will get easier. And my husband and I say that to each other all the time. But like, joke's on us. It's never happened. And it just feels more and more busy. And like, I don't know. There's like a weird balance because like I want to appreciate this time with my kids at this age, but also I'm like, this is really tough and I don't know if I'm going to survive. So but I know we all, we're going through it. If you're parenting, we're in the trenches.
Yeah, definitely. It's hard. I do that a lot too, where I will have like an event or something on the calendar and I'm like, okay, after that, then this is when things are going to slow down. And then it's like, no, because before that even gets there, you've already added things at later dates in the calendar. So it just keeps going and going. And it really, truly just never gets any less busy.
But we're happy, I promise.
Of course. The mom in today's story, Donna Osteen, is a mom who also understood that really delicate labyrinth of family routines all too well. By 2001, Donna was fully immersed in this hustle and bustle of raising a fifth grader and a middle schooler. She was very active in her kids' lives in every way, and she was on the school PTA and volunteered at their schools often. She was a mom who was really invested in making the schools better, not just for her kids, but for all the kids who went there. As any mom with multiple kids will tell you, finding time for everyone's extracurricular activities can be a real challenge, and sometimes we have to get creative to make the most of our time. For Donna's daughter, this meant a regular 7:45 a.m. piano lesson before school each day so that she would be able to fit this in. Donna's usual morning routine was to take her 13-year-old son to school, drop her daughter off for piano practice, and then go back home to make her daughter's lunch before picking her up from the piano lesson at 8:45 and driving her to school. Again, truly incredible to think about the things that moms can get done before 9 o'clock in the morning.
That 7:45 piano lesson really threw me for a loop. I'm like, I'm not momming just as hard as I thought I could.
Me too. At first I thought that, but then I was like, you know what? It isn't that like strange whenever you think about like you and I, we wake up and go for a walk early in the morning. That's just part of our routine. That's what we do. But she goes to a piano lesson. I'm like, it does seem like a strange time to do it. But if that's the time, if that's what time that you have available and you know, she really must love piano and wants to play. So it's like, 7:45 it is,
makes
I guess.
Sense.
But on the morning of November 8th, 2001, after seeing her husband off to work, getting her son off to school, and dropping her daughter off at her piano lesson, Donna returned to her house, and what happened next remains a haunting mystery to this day.
53-year-old Donna Osteen was more than just a great mom. She was a strong and honest person who friends described as being resourceful, feisty, and not afraid to speak up. After growing up on Mercer Island in Washington State with her two siblings, Donna went on to get a degree from the University of Washington in dental hygiene. In February of 1978, Donna married her first husband, an architect named Jim Osteen. But tragically, he passed away in May of 1983 after a nine-month battle with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In 1986, Donna started dating Richard Haney, and eventually the couple got married and had a son and a daughter. Donna kept her last name of Osteen, but her kids had the last name Haney, and most publications refer to the family as being the Haneys. By 2001, Donna and Richard had been married for 14 years, and the kids were growing up. Donna and Richard were running a marine insurance agency together. They also lived in Shilshul Bay, which is near Seattle. I never thought of a marine insurance agency. Like, I just didn't know that was a specific thing, which makes sense, but I just didn't know.
I guess, this is where I'm going to sound ignorant. I'm assuming that's just like boaters insurance.
That's what I would think. I feel like it's
just
the fancy
specifically
way to say
all
it.
They have, all they are selling is boaters insurance. I think, I don't know, because I know that you can get like boaters insurance through your regular insurance company, but right. I'm sure there's also options if you just want to go for like a separate thing. I don't know. I sound ignorant. I am.
You went there a lot in that sentence. So the couple's home was on the water, and it was definitely in what you would consider an upscale neighborhood. The couple's hobbies included sailing and taking ski trips every winter. Donna was actually one of the first women in the area to race sailboats, and she once sailed to the South Pacific with her first husband in their 37-foot boat, the Renaissance. On the morning of Thursday, November 8th, the family woke up and began their usual routine. Richard left for work at around 7:30 that morning, and their 13-year-old went off to school. Donna then did her regular thing of dropping her daughter off for piano practice at 7:45, and she headed back home to make her daughter's lunch. At 8:25 a.m., Donna was at home and she called her sister Shirley, and the two of them had a brief conversation. During this conversation, Donna mentioned that she was in a bad mood that day, but the two didn't talk for very long. At that point, Donna only had a few minutes before she had to leave to pick her daughter up at 8:45 and drive her to school. But 8:45 came and went, and Donna didn't return to get her daughter.
At 9:30, the piano teacher, Virginia, decided to drive Donna's daughter home. When they arrived at the Haney house, Donna's car was parked in the driveway, but her daughter found that all three doors to get inside the main floor of the house were locked. Donna's daughter told Virginia that there was a key hidden in the detached garage that they could use to get inside. When they opened the front door, they were only able to get it open a couple of inches because the safety latch was closed. But Donna's daughter told Virginia that was really unusual because the family never used the safety latch. They started calling for Donna through the crack in the door, but when they got no answer, Virginia had a sinking feeling that something just wasn't right. She wasn't really sure what to do, so she and Donna's daughter went over to a neighboring house where there was a landscaper who was waiting. He was working at this house, and he was actually supposed to trim the trees at Donna's house. A few minutes later, the landscaper, Virginia, and Donna's daughter all went back over to the house, but this time, they found that the side door to the home was open, and as we said previously, this had been shut and locked. The landscaper told Virginia and Donna's daughter to stay outside and wait by the door while he went inside to check things out. As soon as he stepped inside the home, he said that the hairs on the back of his neck stood up, and he just had this terrified feeling and a strong sense that something was very, very wrong. He noticed spots of blood on two of the middle steps that were about the size of a dog's paw if it was bleeding, and at first he thought these spots were makeup, but then he wondered, why is it only on two of the steps? Upstairs, the landscaper saw a piece of clothing on the floor and a TV on its side. It looked like there had been some type of disturbance in the house. At this point, he was scared that there could still be a perpetrator inside. So he went back downstairs and ran to get the neighbor, the house that he had been trimming trees at. He went to get the neighbor that lived at that home. And then he and this neighbor went back inside the Haney home while Virginia and Donna's daughter continued to wait outside. When the men went back upstairs to check all the bedrooms, they noticed that a jewelry box had been ransacked and there were drawers pulled out and costume jewelry spread out all over the bed in the primary bedroom.
At this point, Virginia came up the stairs and called 911 on her phone, and this is just before 10 a.m. As she was walking around, she went all the way inside of the primary bedroom and looked around. That's when she saw 53-year-old Donna, who had been viciously attacked. Virginia left the room and called Richard at work to tell him that Donna was seriously injured and possibly dead. Richard later said that he kind of, quote, went off the deep end, end quote, when he got this news. He ended up having an employee drive him back home. Police arrived on the scene and found Donna's body lying in a short, narrow passage between her bed and bath. She was lying chest down, turned towards the outside wall, with her hands bound behind her back with duct tape. Donna was fully clothed and had been stabbed multiple times between her neck and abdomen. An autopsy would actually later reveal there were 13 stab wounds. There wasn't very much blood at the scene. There was heavy pooling underneath her. There were also some spatters or smears in the bathroom and hall. These smears kind of looked like the killer leaned against the window frames and looked out in different directions. And there was another smear on a bedroom door frame. Inside the house, police found the family dogs confined on the first floor. The doors to the home were locked and the phone line had been cut. There were also smears of blood leading out a back door and down a stairway behind the house. Efforts to block off and search surrounding areas, including possible escape routes, led really nowhere. Even canine units weren't able to find a trail on the killer, who was now long gone. Residents in the local area were completely shocked when they learned that Donna had been brutally murdered in her own home. As we said before, this is a very well-to-do neighborhood where residents said there hadn't been as much as a car theft in several years, let alone any type of violent crime. Meanwhile, Donna's husband Richard was beside himself. Investigators made him wait outside of his house for hours before telling him anything at all. He was left to wonder whether Donna was even dead or alive, but he said after hours of no word, he started to assume that she was dead. He later told Seattle PI how difficult those hours were and how devastated and helpless he felt in that moment. Hours later, they finally told Richard that Donna was killed. The police had made Donna's daughter stay with a neighbor and made their son stay at his school. And Richard wasn't even allowed to see either of the kids for hours, which, oh my gosh, is brutal when you don't know what's going on, your kids don't know what's going on. You're separated. I just can't imagine, like, those hours had to have seemed like years.
It's terrible to even think about. And like, you understand that the police have, you know, an investigation that they're trying to do. They're trying to figure out if, you know, Richard has any clue what's going on or if he is involved in some way. And so you understand like the process, but at the same time, it's like, gosh, I wish there was a better way, because that's, like you said, brutal to think of the kids being at a neighbor's house and stuck at their school and, you know, not even really knowing what was going on and like scared and worried. And then their dad can't even see them. It's just horrible.
I agree. At first, it appeared as though Donna was killed in a burglary gone wrong, but the evidence didn't seem to fit that theory entirely. The killer had brought their own duct tape, knife, and gloves to the house, and the only belongings that were missing were really random items. The killer took some things that weren't worth much money at all, while leaving things behind that actually were worth something. Among the items that were stolen was a half-gallon old pickle jar that was filled with nickels, which weighed about 18 pounds. I truly don't understand taking that. Like, that just seems like
work. Like a pain.
Yeah. Exactly. Also missing was a child-sized lavender-colored combination lock safe, a black outdoors brand backpack, a bank bag, a semicircle bracelet with horses running head to tail, Donna's wedding ring from her first marriage, her wedding ring band from Richard, and Donna's grandmother's wedding ring. The killer left behind a bunch of silver dollars, a nice Omega watch, pearls, and the emerald ring on Donna's finger. And we still have more to get into after a quick break to hear a word from this week's sponsors. I'm loyal to a lot of things, my family, my TV shows, and my razors. And I can't wait to tell you about my favorite one, which is Athena Club. All razors aren't created equal. And when you've had a bad one, boy, do you know. Right out of the box, though, Athena Club razors glide like they're on a mission, thanks to their 5 precision engineered blades. But it doesn't stop there. No, no, no. There's a super moisturizing serum packed with hyaluronic acid, plus built-in skin guards to keep razor burn and irritation at bay. After just one swipe, you'll be feeling smoother than a silk sheet on a summer's day.
Now let's talk price. Brace yourselves for this one. The Athena Club Razor Kit is a jaw-dropping steal at just $10. And while everything else in the world is going up in price, don't let the price tag fool you. This razor screams luxury. With its ergonomic handle that's so gorgeous, it's practically a work of art, and 2 razor heads so sharp they could slice through butter, you'll be treating yourself to a premium shaving experience every time.
And here's the cherry on top, the game-changing magnetic hook. Say goodbye to shower floor mishaps and hello to better organization. This little wonder means no goopy blades and no more frantic searches in the shower caddy. So what are you waiting for? Say hello to your new shaving BFF and wave goodbye to shaving woes forever.
Ready to upgrade your shaving experience? Switch to the best razor on the market and show your skin you care with Athena Club. Head over to athenaclub.com to try their award-winning razor and body products and get 20% off your purchase with code MOMS at checkout. You can also find Athena Club razors at your local Target store. Trust me, you won't look back. Happy shaving! Amidst the chaos of life's demands like kids, chores, and the relentless grind, it often feels like solving for pie. But hey, the rewards of breaking a sweat are priceless. Regular exercise can unlock the secret to a good night's sleep and summon energy levels that rival a toddler on a sugar high. Personally, my fitness routine is my anchor. It's solid, dependable, and the only reason I'm not just bobbing around in life. But not to worry. Regular workouts can be attainable to anyone and everyone thanks to Total Gym. With Total Gym Fit, their latest model, I've uncovered a universe of over 85 exercises neatly packed into one sleek machine. Before Total Gym, I didn't even realize there were so many ways to challenge my body safely. And the best part, even my little ones have embraced it, turning our workouts into a family affair. Let's not forget about the convenience factor either. You can sculpt your entire body in just 10 to 20 minutes, which is about the same time it takes me to decide on dinner plans. So really, there's no excuse. You could finish a workout or 3 before we end today's podcast.
Total Gym can be found in over 4 million households, so you know this is a brand you can really trust. But to make things even sweeter, Total Gym will let you try it for just $1 plus free shipping. Seriously, you can try the whole Total Gym for 30 days for $1 plus free shipping. Remember, it only takes 10 to 20 minutes a day to reshape your body. Head to totalgymdirect.com/moms for an additional 20% off your order. Plus, that includes a free ab crunch attachment and free shipping. This special offer won't be available for much longer. That's totalgymdirect.com/moms for an additional 20% off. And make sure you go to our URL, totalgymdirect.com/moms, so they know we sent you. And now back to the episode.
So before the break, we were talking about the murder of a woman named Donna Osteen, and she was killed in her own home in a neighborhood that is very close to Seattle, Washington. There really weren't a lot of clues left behind to kind of work with to figure out who would have done this. And Donna really didn't have any enemies to speak of. So since it didn't really make any sense what happened to her, her husband became the first suspect, because husbands are often the first suspect. Although Richard was at work when the murder took place, the police still wanted to fully investigate him. He was subject to hours of interrogation, he gave his blood samples, and he even took a polygraph before he was ultimately ruled out. Police asked Richard personal questions about his marriage to Donna, like whether they were having affairs or if anyone had been bothering Donna lately. He told the police that he actually lived and worked with Donna, and they had very busy schedules with the kids, so neither one of them had the time for a secret life or to even have an affair. He also said that Donna had never mentioned anybody bothering her. Another early suspect was a man who lived in a rundown cabin at the foot of a bluff that Donna's neighborhood overlooked. The man's cabin was searched and he was questioned, but he was also eventually released. Investigators also heard about a transient who allegedly went to a local tavern and was bragging that he had killed a woman. But the police were able to track this man down and speak to him, and he was quickly dismissed as a suspect in Donna's murder. Donna's family released a statement on November 9th expressing their hope that the Seattle Police Department would be able to find the person responsible. Donna's daughter wrote a tribute letter that talked about what an amazing mom and amazing person Donna was. But unfortunately, after this initial wave of media attention, Donna's case stalled, and there weren't many updates or articles written about her case, which many speculate is because the police department was busy prioritizing a different case above all others. About 3.5 weeks before Donna was murdered, Assistant United States Attorney Thomas Wales was killed in the local area, and Donna's family believes that case was given many resources while Donna's case was not. Donna's sister Shirley said that in Thomas's murder, there were 4 or 5 FBI agents and a Seattle detective assigned to it. But in Donna's murder, there was only 1 detective assigned to work on the case, and that detective also had a pretty heavy caseload with 10 to 20 other cases to work on at the same time.
10 to 20 blows my mind for one person. Like, even if you have... I truly can't wrap my mind around it. Like, that is just so much for one person to be doing, to be able to really give their time. They can't really give their time to it.
Truly. All we're doing here is making a podcast, and to even think about working on 10 stories at the same time, it's just like, and that's nothing. This is actually, you know, investigating.
Right.
This is really digging into these cases and doing hard work to solve them. And just to think, like you said, about one person trying to balance that many cases, it's really sad. It really is. Like, we need more manpower for investigating things like this, for sure.
Absolutely. There is a long form podcast about the assassination of Thomas Wales, and it's called Somebody Somewhere. I actually downloaded it yesterday. I want to listen to it, but I wanted us to get through our episode before I took that on so I didn't get confused. So we aren't going to go too deep into a story here. If you do listen to Somebody Somewhere, it's the first season. But we do want to talk a little about what happened in Thomas's case. So Thomas was originally from Boston, which is where he grew up with his brother and his sister. He was super intelligent and funny, and he was known for just being a wonderful person and a passionate advocate who was always there to help others. He was also a poet and an athlete, which are 2 things I don't really hear together very often. Tom went to the historic Massachusetts Milton Academy, and in 1968, he was rooming with Senator Robert Kennedy's son, Joseph. When Kennedy was assassinated, Tom helped Joseph through that difficult time. Tom graduated from Harvard in 1974, and then he earned a law degree from Hofstra University of Law in 1979. At first, after graduation, he worked in a Wall Street law firm, but he really wanted to be in public service, so he took a job for the U.S. Attorney's Office. In 1983, he started working as a federal prosecutor in the fraud unit in Seattle. He specialized in prosecuting banking and business crime. He was also a gun control activist and the president of the board of the Washington Ceasefire, which is a group that is working towards ending gun violence. Tom was married to a woman named Elizabeth, and they had a son and a daughter. And although the couple was divorced at the time of Tom's murder, the two were still really best friends. It was October 11th, 2001, when Tom was up late working in the basement of his home when a gunman came through the backyard, undetected, and walked up to the basement window where Tom was and fired at least 4 shots, hitting Tom in the neck and the side. Hearing gunshots in Tom's neighborhood was very unusual, so a neighbor looked outside to see what was going on, and she said she saw a white man walking down the street really fast. She said he got into a car that was parked under a tree, and he took off. Police were called, and Tom was rushed to the hospital, but unfortunately, he passed away just hours later.
As you can imagine, the murder of a state prosecutor was a huge deal, so the story became the number one criminal case in Seattle at that time. The Seattle police, the FBI, and the ATF were swarming the case, and the FBI gave Tom's murder Bureau Major Case status, which is interesting because less than 200 investigations have ever been given that classification. Essentially, Tom's murder was treated by the FBI with the same level of urgency as the Unabomber case.
Wow.
They even offered a $1 million reward and assigned multiple agents to work on it full time. This is something, a fact that was included by Haley in the research, but it could have been the reason this case could have been such a, you know, a big deal. Obviously, it is a big deal, but it could have been made a bigger deal because if it were to be found out that Tom was killed because of like a revenge thing, something related to right. his position, you know, as a, you know, state attorney, then he would be the first U.S. state attorney to be killed in the line of duty. So this was like a really big, kind of a really big, you know, monumental case. So it was determined that Tom was sitting just a few feet away from the basement window, which did not have a curtain on it at the time that he was shot. Tom's home office itself was really well lit, but the killer had slipped through the dark and narrow cement walkway between Tom's house and the house next door and managed to evade setting off the motion sensor lights. The killer would have had to go back out the same way they had come in. Tom was shot with a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. And the brand that of gun that he was shot with, Makarov, was a really popular gun that's on that they see on the streets a lot because it is a very small, compact size, but it's still a 9mm, so it has a very powerful punch to it. And the gun that was used in the murder had actually been fitted with a replacement barrel that had left specific marks on the bullets that were fired from the gun. Investigators tried to figure out a motive for Tom's murder. Although, as we said before, he was extremely well-liked in his personal life and around the office, his profession did give people, specifically criminals that he helped put away, a motive to kill him. In 18 years at the Seattle U.S. Attorney's Office, he had never lost a single case that he had worked on, and the types of criminals that he was helping put away were white-collar people who would really be more likely to have the resources to hire a hitman if they wanted to. Investigators also questioned whether Tom's activism in gun control could have had anything to do with his death. The irony that Tom was killed with a handgun led to widespread speculation that Tom's killer must have been some kind of gun, you know, fanatic, if you will. The speculation was fueled by the fact that on the day Tom was killed, he was actually pushing a proposal that would require background checks at state gun shows. By December, authorities were honing in on one single suspect. It was a commercial pilot and avid gun enthusiast who was indicted for felony fraud in September of 2000. The pilot and his business partners allegedly altered a military surplus helicopter for civilian use, which, of course, violated FAA policy and safety rules. Many months later, though, the case fell apart because an FAA expert disputed the government's theory and the charges against the pilot and his co-defendants ended up getting dismissed after their companies pleaded guilty to violating FAA procedure. So basically they said, like, yeah, we'll plead guilty to that if, you know, we don't continue pressing further charges on these particular individuals. So even though the pilot was not convicted, he claimed that his reputation was damaged and he ended up running up $125,000 in legal fees. So he sued the government for frivolous and wrongful prosecution. And this is a lawsuit that was still pending when Tom was killed.
So the FBI started looking into this guy as a suspect. They searched his homes and told reporters that they had plenty of circumstantial evidence against the pilot. The pilot, though, has refused to be questioned by authorities. The FBI said that it's possible that the pilot has friends who could supply an alibi or give information that might clear him, but they won't talk to the authorities either. Some people who knew the pilot told Seattle Magazine that he did have an alibi and that he was at his home near Bellevue talking on the phone at the time Tom was shot. In 2004, the FBI found out that one of Tom's neighbors had reported a suspicious man in the neighborhood shortly before Tom was murdered. This information had somehow slipped through the cracks during this immediate investigation, but the neighbor who reported the man was able to help investigators produce a sketch. For there to have been 4 to 5 full-time people on this and an FBI agent and everything else, I can't believe anything fell through the cracks when you're looking at the other caseload that some people have. So this suspicious man was described as being in his late 30s or early 40s with a slim build, black hair, stained teeth, and a chipped left front tooth. The sketch wasn't seen as being important at first, but that would change many years later in 2021. Over the years, the FBI continued to learn more and came to the conclusion that Tom's murder was a revenge hit carried out on behalf of this pilot, and they started honing in on a small group of people who they believe had knowledge of the killing. In 2021, new information emerged that the FBI was looking into evidence that the pilot enlisted the help of a notorious drug cartel to arrange Tom's murder, and that a lower-level career criminal was recruited to carry out the hit as a means of paying off a drug debt. Oh my gosh. So according to this theory, the pilot, who was suspected of drug smuggling, reaches out to his connections with a Mexican drug cartel and asks them to help have Tom killed. So this cartel had operations in Washington with ties to a drug ring in Kitsap County, where a man who owed money in connection with that drug ring was recruited to carry out the hit. Clear as mud. The man allegedly enlisted another man who was later identified as suspect number one in court documents to be the lookout person while he killed Tom. The second man reportedly looks a lot like the sketch of the man seen outside Tom's house in the weeks leading up to his murder, which it really does sound like you had to know something about his house, about everything. Definitely. Somebody had to have staked that out for them to be able to sneak up on him like that. Unfortunately, though, that's the last information there is regarding the assassination of Tom Wales. The pilot has always maintained his innocence, and there have been no updates since 2021. Tom's case is still unsolved, and if you have any information about his murder, you can call your local FBI office or email WalesTips, that's WalesTips, at FBI.gov. There's actually now a $2 million reward. And we're going to get right back into where things are currently with Donna Osteen's case after one last break to hear a word from this week's sponsors. Welcome to a whole new world of shopping. Quince is your ticket to elevating your wardrobe without breaking the bank. Picture this, 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for just $50. Or organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and even timeless 14-karat gold jewelry, all at prices that you can actually feel good about.
Here's the kicker. Every single Quince item comes at a steal, priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd pay elsewhere. Like me, you're probably wondering how this is even possible. Well, Quince actually teams up directly with top factories, which means you aren't paying for the middleman. Instead, Quince passes on the savings straight to you.
It's hard to really pick out one Quince piece to even talk about because I've had a few orders now, and each one is just my new favorite thing. I will say right now, my favorite and my go-to are these European linen shorts that are in the color deep navy. I wear them with literally everything, and they were under $30, but I've actually seen a similar pair for more than double that in another store.
Quince also takes pride in its ethical approach. They only partner with factories that uphold safe, responsible manufacturing practices and use premium fabrics and finishes. So why wait? Dive into luxury without the guilt. Shop Quince today and make your wardrobe dreams a reality without emptying your wallet.
Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/moms for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/moms to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/moms. Managing subscriptions can be more than a little overwhelming, and it's super easy to lose track of what you've signed up for. Sometimes you wish there was a company that could just simplify the process by helping you cancel unwanted subscriptions hassle-free, and that's why we love Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Whether you just get anxious about making calls to cancel things or you simply don't have the time, Rocket Money can take care of it for you and even try to negotiate to lower your bills for you by up to 20%. All you need to do is take a photo of your bill and they'll handle the customer service calls and all the other less than fun stuff that comes with those calls. Rocket Money also helps with monitoring your spending. This is one of my favorite parts about the app. I get notified of the subscriptions I have, as well as how much I've spent this week compared to last week or last month, and it really helps me track my spending habits so I can see where I need to make changes, as well as subscriptions that need to be canceled. And it's not just us. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/moms. That's rocketmoney.com/moms. rocketmoney.com/moms. Are you ready to revolutionize the way you enjoy food and essentials at home? Introducing DashPass from DoorDash, your ultimate ticket to convenience and savings. With DashPass, you gain exclusive access to unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders, along with members-only deals and discounts that will leave your wallet smiling. Whether you're craving the flavors of your favorite restaurants, need groceries from across town, or anything in between, DashPass ensures that everything you need is just a few clicks away, delivered right to your door. With DashPass, not only do you enjoy $0 delivery fees, but you'll also benefit from lower service fees on eligible orders, making it the most affordable way to satisfy your cravings and stock up on essentials from your local favorites. What I really love is how quickly DashPass pays for itself. On average, it takes just 2 orders, which makes it a no-brainer investment for your budget. And as if that weren't enough, DashPass grants you special access to exclusive promotions and menu items, adding an extra layer of excitement to your DoorDash experience. You get all this for only $9.99 a month, which is a small price to pay for unlimited convenience and savings. My family and I have had DoorDash for the past year or so, and while I make most meals at home, I don't know that I could mom without it. I used it twice just this past week while we were dealing with a stomach bug at home, and it was so nice to have and to be able to focus on getting better and not running all over town to pick everything up for everyone. Don't wait. Sign up for DashPass now and unlock a world of possibilities, all from the comfort of your home. DashPass from DoorDash, delivering joy, convenience, and savings straight to your doorstep.
Get more from delivery for less with DashPass. $0 delivery fees and reduced service fees on eligible DoorDash orders. Sign up for DashPass today and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change. Terms apply. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today, only on DoorDash, and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
And now back to the episode.
So before the break, we first started getting into the story of Donna Osteen, who was a mother of two who was killed in her own home. And the police really weren't sure what direction to go in. Her case was starting to go cold, and it really stopped getting as much attention. Donna's family believes that the reason Donna's case didn't get as much attention is because of the murder of a U.S. state attorney named Thomas Wales. And we also talked about the details of his murder right before we took our last ad break. His murder as well is still unsolved. We gave some information about who to contact if you have any information about that case as well. But back to Donna Osteen's case. Things, as we said, were really falling through the cracks while the FBI and the Seattle PD were busy investigating Tom's murder. After 6 months had passed, Donna's husband Richard told Seattle PI that he and the kids were really struggling in the wake of Donna's loss. They weren't able to stay in the house where Donna was killed, but Richard would return every now and then to go to the house to get things ready to rent it out. He had decided to rent the house out instead of selling it because it was the only house the kids had known, and they hoped that one day, once time had passed and they all had a chance to heal, they might be able to move back into the house because Richard said that the home meant so much to their family. Richard also talked about the struggle of adapting to life as a single parent and being the only one available for things like school pickups and lessons and sports, doctor's visits, and everything else, all while running the business and checking in with detectives about Donna's case. All Richard said he wanted to do was provide a normal life for his kids, but it's so hard to get past the huge hole left behind when Donna was killed. He said that if he and Donna didn't have 2 kids together that needed to be loved and cared for, he may have just let himself sink into the grief, but their kids are what keep him going. Hearing the things that, you know, Richard said about Donna, it really just puts into perspective, you know, that people, like, these are real things that happen and, like, really affect people's lives in such a deep, deep way. I just,
forever.
My heart really, like, breaks for him, you know, thinking about him and the kids and kind of just any family having to adjust to losing a parent, you know, in their household and you have young kids to raise is just, it's just truly one of the most heartbreaking things.
Totally.
Richard said that he and the kids were doing okay and they were happy to see the return of sailing season soon because Donna loves sailing so much. But he said, you know, Mother's Day is also around the corner and that's always tough for the kids. Richard stays in touch with detectives because he said he never wants Donna's case to just get pushed to the side of a desk. He believes that Donna's killer had to be someone she knew and maybe even let inside herself, whether it was a friend or just someone that she had met once before. And he said he thinks that when they finally figure out who killed Donna, it's going to shock everyone. Richard also wonders whether Donna's killer could be another dad that Donna met through their kids' sports, or someone who just became infatuated with her after meeting her at a community meeting or the PTA. Maybe she had a stalker who finally got the courage to come to her house. Richard pointed out that his wife was a very attractive woman. On the other hand, Donna wasn't a tiny or timid woman either. She was 5'6" and in great shape, and likely would have fought very hard for her life. She wasn't someone to just be pushed around. So Richard has a lot of questions about how the killer managed to bind Donna's wrists with duct tape, and he questions whether she was somehow subdued beforehand. Richard said that he has these vivid dreams that Donna is still alive and happy, and some of the hardest times come after he wakes up from those dreams.
That is so specific, and you can absolutely see how that would be just gut-wrenching to see this loved person, yeah, in this happy state and then wake up and realize that's not true. So Donna's case continued to stall and got very little media attention. At the one-year anniversary, multiple people reported to Seattle PI that they had tried to give tips but never heard back from detectives. Meanwhile, police claimed they were investigating leads and that they even followed one lead all the way to Saudi Arabia, but it ended up leading nowhere. In November of 2004, the police said that some people have been less cooperative than they would have liked and have even refused to speak to police, or they would get a lawyer, or they refused to share their DNA, but police made sure to point out that Richard was not one of these difficult people. He had complied with every request from authorities. Also at that time, the police released two sketches of persons of interest and photos of replicas of items that were stolen from Donna's house. But they said these people of interest weren't necessarily suspects, they were just people that police wanted to identify. One suspect is described as being a white male, possibly in his 30s or 40s, about 6 feet tall, 180 to 200 pounds. He was wearing a white, long-sleeved, painter-type shirt, matching white painter pants, an orange see-through traffic-type vest, and a white hard hat. His hair is light brown to blonde with a box cut and no scruff on the neck. It was similar, they said, to a Dutch boy haircut. He may have had a mustache and possibly bad skin or acne. The other person is described as being a white male, about 40 years old, 6 feet tall, with a medium build. He was dressed like a construction worker in clean clothing. Richard was frustrated that police had spent so many resources investigating him in the beginning, even though he understood their procedure, which we know, like they're going to look at the people close to them at first, but still when it ends up not being them, it's so hard. So he just wishes that other things had been done earlier on, things like checking with pawn shops for that stolen jewelry or even releasing the sketches sooner.
In November of 2011, 10 years had passed since Donna's murder, and her family told Westside Seattle that they feel there's a good reason to believe the killer was familiar with the house because the floor plan was more complicated than your average home. Other than the idea that Donna may have had a stalker, Richard still can't think of any reason why somebody would have wanted Donna dead. As of today, the murders of both Donna Osteen and Thomas Wales remain unsolved. In September of 2023, Richard spoke to King 5 News and said that at first, he just wanted Donna's killer to face a firing squad. But now he hopes that the killer can be one day caught and locked up for life without parole. He said, quote, "It's tough to realize that this person killed your wife and he's out there free running around." Richard is still hopeful that someone will come forward with information so that the case can finally be solved. He said, quote, "She was a really good mother, a good wife. She was a kind and caring person, loved movies, loved sailing." And Donna's brother said, "Hopefully justice will be served. That won't ever relieve the ache in our hearts for our sister that's gone." The Seattle Police Department said they are still investigating Donna's murder, and they asked that anyone who has information call the Seattle Police Department tip line at 206-233-5000.
Man, it's so hard, and seeing these two cases take place nearby around the same time, and you see this all the time, really, with inequality and how cases are handled. And while you still want Tom's case to be, you know, properly investigated. I think the big thing is it just stinks that we don't have more people, like you were saying, more manpower to look into these cases faster and to be able to follow up on leads sooner and stuff like that. So it's really sad. And I can't imagine it, like having no idea who did this to your loved one. Just it just being a total blank. You just don't know. The person could be out going around right now and you have no idea. That's so upsetting.
And stories like Donna's always are, I don't think fascinating is the right word, but it's just so like, it just really makes you think, because Donna was on the phone with her sister, you know, at 8:25 in the morning. She was supposed to be back to pick her daughter up at 8:45. There's only 20 minutes, you know, and it's like just to even think about what happened, you know, in that time after she hung up the phone, and, you know, was somebody already in the house or did somebody come over at that moment? It's just so many questions that you have, you know, that you want answers to. And then to even think, like we said, like it's frustrating to think about some cases taking priority and getting a lot more, you know, resources assigned to them. But then look in this case with Tom, you know, they did that and they still haven't solved that case either. And so it's like frustrating from all sides, you know, for Donna's family who wishes they had more resources. And then, you know, I'm sure Tom's family is frustrated that they do have all these resources and they still can't figure out, you know, what happened in his case. It's just police work and investigating is definitely just such an important job. And I feel like one that, you know, I feel like people do give credit to that profession, but I just don't feel like a lot of people fully understand like how complicated and difficult it can be sometimes. And sometimes all the money and resources in the world still aren't enough to be able to solve, you know, a really big crime.
For sure. That actually reminds me, there's this new show on Netflix called Missing, Dead or Alive. And it's working with this police department, and I apologize, I don't remember the state. I wasn't thinking of talking about this, but they are following these people who get these missing persons calls, these officers, and they're following each one. So they'll get the call, they start talking to the family, blah, blah, blah. And by the end of each episode, you find out if the person is missing, if they found them, or if they had been dead or murdered. It was two women really were the like main people in these episodes, but it was really fascinating to see them, like to hear all the sides of it and really the emotional work it would take. And one of them really was considering getting out of missing persons because it was so difficult, and having to tell family members, or she found one guy and she thought, like, if I had found him the day before, I was so close, and, you know, found his body, man. and like having those kind of thoughts, like you said, it's a special job. It's a tough job. And I'm glad there are people that are cut out for it. I'm not one of them, but I respect people that are.
Yeah. And you do hear that too. Even just kind of going way off now, but when we just recently visited Othram and we got to hear a police officer talking about a case that he had been working on for years, and really got a feel for, like you said, that emotional side that these investigators, you know, they get attached to these cases. There are certain cases and there's ones that just break some investigators. Like they don't want to do the job anymore because they do get so emotionally invested to these stories. And, you know, of course they're always over the moon whenever they can solve a case, especially one that's been unsolved for a long time. But like you said, the emotional bandwidth and like everything that you give of yourself in the course of solving that, it's like, it really is a lot to give of yourself to do that type of work. So
for sure.
Yeah, definitely have so much respect for people doing investigative work for just the most terrible things you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on. Let's turn the page and do a last thing before we go, before we get out of here this week, do our little palate cleanser, if you will. So this week, we're just going to do a little, I'm going to give Melissa some statistics, and it's going to be kind of like a true or false thing. I'm going to say the statistic, and then Melissa's going to tell me if she thinks what I told her is too high, too low, or if it's actually the accurate statistic.
I am so excited about this because I'm terrible at numbers. So I feel like there's a chance I won't get any of these.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we'll find out. All right. So Melissa, we've joked around a lot before that our cars being full of trash is like how we initially met and bonded with each other. So do you think that the average American, do you think it is too high, too low, or right on the money that the average American each produces about 5.91 pounds of waste every day?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I can say under exactly or over.
Yes. So do you think 5.91 pounds per person of garbage that includes things that you put in the trash and recycling? So total of things that you are discarding for one person, 5.91 pounds every day. What do you think? Too high, too low, or right on?
I feel like it's too low, but I want it to be too high.
So it's actually right.
Oh my gosh, of course, the one I didn't pick.
Yeah.
Yikes.
So that's a lot. Yeah. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that 4.4 pounds per person goes into the trash each day and 1.51 pounds are recycled.
Oh my gosh.
Per person. So that means a four-person household on average is throwing away over 20 pounds of garbage a day.
That's a lot. Yeah, that is. Wow. Okay. Okay. Well, we're learning lessons here as well.
Okay, Melissa, next one. This pertains to something. I feel like I'm feeling good about this one for you. I feel like you might have a good sense of whether this one is right or wrong.
I have almost no faith in myself, so I'm happy you do.
Sorry. This is not quite a statistic. This really is more of a true or false. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I don't even understand the rules of my own game here. Okay, sorry. A recent survey found that Americans prefer to eat French fries over every single other way to eat a potato. True or false?
Ooh, Americans, you said?
Americans. So you got to think, you're also comparing this. There's baked potatoes, there's mashed potatoes, there's potato chips. So
French
fries. Americans prefer French fries over everything else?
Yes.
We do. Yes, we do.
And the way I know that is every meal you get at a fast food restaurant, your option is French fries.
That's true. Yeah. Actually, that's kind of annoying now that I think about it. I don't always want French fries.
I always want French fries. So I was making that guess based on me as that American that I always want French fries. Except this week we've had the stomach bug and I'm still eating applesauce. I had bread earlier. I'm getting there.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
No, it's not great.
Okay, next one. The global rate for washing hands after going to the bathroom. The global rate for hand washing after going to the bathroom is over 60%.
I feel like people are so gross. I'm going to say that that's too high.
You are actually correct.
That's
this is so,
so
disgusting.
Gross.
The global rate for washing hands after using the toilet is actually under 20%.
I'm sorry.
According to the CDC.
Okay. We now have signs in there. There's signs everywhere. Like, how do you even, just from like a personal hygiene thing, how, okay, keep going.
That's what the CDC says. Around the globe, only 19% of people wash their hands after using the toilet.
19%. Oh, my
so
gosh.
Crazy. Literally, that's the craziest fact I think I've ever heard.
Oh, gosh. Don't ever touch somebody's phone. I always think that. I'm like, I don't want anybody to hand me their phone because I'm like, you brought that in the bathroom. I know I bring mine in the bathroom. Duh. But what if now 19% of them only wash? Okay. I'm going through it. Go ahead. Continue.
Okay. Okay, here's another one that's kind of fun. The average American eats nearly 30 pounds of ice cream per year.
Ooh, 30 pounds? Let's say...
Per year, per person.
Oh, gosh. I actually don't, but my husband might. So I'm going to say it's right on the money.
So it's a little high. It's actually 13 pounds.
Okay.
But that still seems like a lot of ice cream. 13 pounds of ice cream?
It is. In the last few years, I just can't eat ice cream because it hurts my tum-tum. And so I bring it down. I bring that statistic down. It probably was 30 pounds a year until I stopped eating it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, Melissa, this will be our last one. And hopefully it won't enrage you too much because when I saw this, I absolutely was enraged. So we collectively, as a country, as people with registered phone numbers in the United States, collectively, we receive about 2.4 billion robocalls per month.
Oh my gosh. I feel like that might be low if it's like millions of people in the US. I think it could be low because I feel like I get multiple a week.
So it's actually right on.
Dang it, Mandy.
2.4 billion per month. Yeah. The FCC estimated that about 60% of all the complaints it even receives are about unwanted calls, and that Americans in total receive about 2.4 billion robocalls per month.
Wow. I mean, that's yeah. And they're just getting trickier and trickier with everything. I get so anxious. Like, I don't know. I always, when my kids are in school, I want to answer every call just like in case there's an emergency. And that's when robocalls get me because I'm like, dang it.
I can't stand robocalls and things. And then you know what the other thing, I feel like the new age robocall is like bots on the internet, right? Like every forum and like everywhere you go, like you see these comments and you're like, a real person did not write that, right? Like
totally.
But who's falling for these things is what I want to know. Do you ever see the ones that like the comments where it's like, I had a really bad experience and Mr. Merriweather helped me get through by getting me a loan approved for this, this, and this, and send me a DM. I know.
Like, it's only people who are brand new on the internet that day, I have to believe. But it is always like, and it's nothing to do with the Instagram thing.
What's posted.
OJ Simpson's dead. And then that is literally what the comment is. And you're like, who is this man? Who is
Mr.? I'm so thankful for Mrs. White for helping me. Like, what is happening right now?
No, I agree. And I have seen those more and more. I feel like Instagram is very wild for that one. They're always getting it.
Instagram is getting a little out of control, I feel like, with the bots and like the robo comments and things like that, for sure. I've been seeing it a lot more. And they really should crack down on it because some of the stuff I see is like not cool. That's like getting on Instagram right now. So yeah, that's a conversation for another day. Maybe we'll talk about that on Moms and Miscellaneous next time. About
that and Twitter.
Away from certain things.
Totally. Yeah. It's rough out there.
It definitely is. All right, guys. Well, that was the episode for this week. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week. Same time, same place, new story.
Have a great week.
Bye.